we were building upon the foundation of this Migration Institute, which has a fantastic tradition and history here. And together with the university, we could build something really big. So that's sort of this really exciting thing that's really starting now. And then at the same time, the electronic transformation, digitalization of the world has helped us to really understand things. So that is working with the electronic workshops here, the engineering workshops, that allowed us to learn things about animal behavior and the life of animals that we could never know before. So now we can study animals for their entire life. And that actually brought us into the world, because our animals with these electronic devices ended up in places that we never expected them to end up. And they certainly have a lot of trauma, because they are shot, they are poisoned, they are electrocuted, they are eaten by tigers and lions and whatnot. And human beings, yes. And then the other side was that we always had to send people there and say, well, you know, there is our black box, this electronic logger. We want that back. We want to give that back to the engineers to read out the data in next door in the workshop here, in the electronic engineering workshops. And how can we do that? And then you end up sending people to Southern Sudan and to Ethiopia and Nigeria and places where, you know, it's difficult to travel. The UN workers don't go there. It's really hard. And then somehow the kids actually came to us and said, well, why don't you make a story out of that? So that was the one side. This Maxine kids, they came and said, hey, we think this should be, there should be something written and maybe even animated. And then Brigitte Keefe said, oh, I know somebody who's doing some crazy stuff on migration, also trauma of migration in people, because it happens all the time and is often actually linked together. So our animals tell us about the trauma of people and vice versa, and that's how the United Nations and FAO actually want to link this together now. It's really interesting. So that the animals that sort of accompany the people that you're working with tell us what the people are doing and vice versa. And that's how we ended up talking about this. And then also the work that Wolfgang Fiedler is pioneering on life histories of these animals is really exciting, because you can track them for the entire lifetime. You know them from the nest until the place they die, and you know everything they're doing. And part of that is that we also not just know individuals, but we know collectives. And this is what Andrea Fluck is pioneering. And we'll hear about that today. And I think that's so exciting that we said, well, you know, we need something to show what these animals are doing and what we are doing. And we also need it because we are sending people to these places, and often at the borders with our equipment, the border agents ask us, well, what is this? And then we say, you know, this is about a bird, and this is on the bird, and it's flying around the world. And then they say, oh, you know, these guys are crazy. And then we say, we need something that we can show, all of us can just show, and it has to be something that everybody understands. And then this is when you came in, and we thought, well, this is a universal language. I mean, it's now underlaid with some human language, but it works without. So you can show it to people. So we can have all our staff have this little animation and go to border control in Southern Sudan and say, well, this is what we're doing. And everybody understands. And this is why we are so glad you're here and are showing us the future of what we can show the world about the life histories, the individual traumas, and the fun that animals experience in the world. So, welcome.
Good evening. Can you hear me without this?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah, all right. Yes?
Yeah?
You can't, sorry, you're very important. Good evening, thank you so much for inviting me, Martin and Bea. It's a pleasure to go. I look at Constance as almost a second home. I have a number of wonderful dear friends in this city, and not you. And it's just lovely to come back every time to Constance, see my friends, and this time to be invited to present our work. So as Martin said, we've been working for about a year now on this project, and it's a very different project to what we normally do at Positive Negatives. I focus on human trauma and mostly human migration. And so before we go into the Stork project, I thought it would be interesting to see how and why this came about and why we do the work that we do at Positive Negatives with animations and this kind of storytelling. So I'm going to take you on a bit of a journey about human migration from Sri Lanka. And do I flick? Okay. So this, talking of Sudan, this was in this picture is in South Sudan, where I was working with landmine removal, another great evil of the world that hampers people and development as people grow. And this was basically, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do is tell human stories by anonymizing people who might have security issues or identity issues to be able, through their governments or militia groups in the areas where they work. So this story starts in 2004, when I was a photojournalist in India, and the tsunami hit on Boxing Day 2004. And an old friend of mine was working in a place called Vani, which was in northern Sri Lanka. And the tsunami completely ravaged this eastern shore of Sri Lanka, where about 36,000 people died. And so I went over there 2 days later on the 28th of December 2004. And I thought I was going there for about 10 days to help and to be a pillar of support for my friend. And I ended up staying 4 years. When I got there, this was the Tamil Tiger held area of North Sri Lanka. And it was a place that had been ravaged by about 30 years of conflict. It was ravaged with landmines, and it was a very, very vulnerable and sensitive community that was constantly going through periods of conflict and peace. What I got very interested at that time was the distinction between the Tamil and the Tiger. And this photograph that I took was kind of showing that distinction, really, that in a conflict setting, it was very difficult. The lines became blurred between the civilian and the combatant. And this gave a very sensitive and difficult environment, but it was politically very fascinating to kind of be a part of and to witness and to interview people. Throughout 2007 and 8, the conflict between the Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tigers started to spiral into a horrific conflict. And my job was to go out into these kind of borderland areas and interview people who had been affected by the violence. This child here had recently had his house destroyed the night before by an artillery shell. You might be able to see a hit here. And he was incredibly traumatized by what he had experienced. And his father was trying to move them away from that battle zone. So what I then started to see was the vulnerability of people in conflict, that when people move away from fighting, the first time they move away, they might have some money in their pocket. They've got space and time to be able to make decisions. So they can fill a tractor like this with their material assets and make a journey away from their home to a safe place. But then as the fighting catches up with them, suddenly the tractor turns away. There's not so much material assets, and it's more and more people. What I love about this picture is, even in the middle of a war zone, people still found it funny that there was a big white guy standing on the side of the street taking pictures. And this was very much an effect of this community, that it was an incredibly welcoming and hospitable community to me as an outsider. But as this conflict spiraled, we went into complete chaos. And this was about 500,000 people on the move, running around the jungle in chaos, in panic, trying to get away from the fighting. And throughout that time, I was working for the United Nations, and our area of operations started to shrink and shrink into a very small, localized area where we couldn't really work anymore. So in September 2008, the United Nations said they were going to evacuate from the Vani, from North Sri Lanka, as it was too dangerous for us international staff. So as that started to spiral, I went out and I started to take photographs like this, which really symbolized to me the way that we left nearly 500,000 people with just the clothes on their back and hardly any security. We put up a lot of resistance to the United Nations that we should stay in Sri Lanka. But on the morning of September the 16th, we drove out of there. And this was a moment at about 11 o'clock in the morning that completely shaped the course of my life. And it hugely traumatized me that we were abandoning the people that I'd been working with for 4 years. So as I drove out of there, I was kind of heartbroken, but also determined that I was going to turn this incredibly horrific experience into something positive. So I came back to the UK. For about 2 years, I suffered from post-traumatic stress. We lost about 33 of my colleagues who died in the conflict. And I decided that I wanted to tell this story of what people had experienced, the way that people experience conflict and migrate from conflict and come to Europe as refugees in a new and engaging and innovative way. And so I thought about comics and illustrations, because the one thing this did, like the first picture I showed you, it allows us to anonymize people who in 2009 and 10, when we started working on this, this is a photograph of this girl, but I didn't know what fate she would have if I showed the world her photograph, what repercussions that would have back in Sri Lanka. So I started working with an artist, and quite rapidly I realized what I was doing here of turning these stories into artwork was a PhD in anthropology. So I started working on that, of the transition between complex traumatic testimonies into art practice. And this was my apartment in New Delhi in India, where I started to go a little bit crazy, and the landlord would walk in and kind of look at all these writings on the wall and then leave. And I developed this methodology where I would keep taking the story back to the respondent who I was interviewing and asking them to keep checking and checking the script that we were writing, that I was writing from their story. We would then take my photographs and start to turn them into these illustrations. And so suddenly, back in 2010, it would have been very problematic, like I said, to show this photograph of these people's faces. But when I presented them like this, it was okay. You could suddenly tell their story and they had that security behind the illustrations. I would then take the illustrations back to the respondents and they would start to check and give me comments on the artwork itself, that this looks like their home and it feels like their home and their places. And so this would go on and on and on, this process. And what I found by using this medium of art, we were able to go into the spaces that you can't really show through film or photography or just narrative. Like this, for example, an explosion from a bomb blast was inside this man Indran's head, where he had seen this explosion. And by sitting with me and the artist, we were able to extract his memory and what he is dealing with by showing these pictures. But then also what we could also show was the subtleties in conflict. Things like this, where a family, suddenly there's a quiet piece in the conflict, in the war, and a family can sit round a fire and have a really sensitive, kind of very human interaction amongst the chaos of the war. And then also these moments where a son may fall asleep on a father's lap, a husband and wife suddenly have some time together in the conflict. And these are moments that we don't often see on the news or in war films or whatever. It's always about the big drama. And there are so many different layers and subtleties in conflict and migration. And then one of the really interesting things was the actual migration story of bringing the protagonist from Sri Lanka all the way to Europe and have this person standing in Europe remembering all of the traumas that they had back in Sri Lanka, of sitting in a bedsit while they're waiting for asylum and watching the television and remembering the issues that they had back at home. So this is the book that we've created, Vani, which came out about 2 weeks ago. And afterwards, I have a copy which you can have a look at, and please feel free to ask me any questions about it. And so as I was going through all of that, I set up Positive Negatives, which is an organization which does this kind of work. And we now work in about 34 countries across the world. These are all of our projects that we have on at the moment, about migration, about drug issues in Afghanistan, Myanmar, Colombia, migration around the Horn of Africa. This is a Sri Lanka story, and I've embarrassingly just realized, I'm very sorry, Martin, I've forgotten our one for the Storm project. That's all right, because I'll present that now. So this is what we're currently working on. And it's a map that hangs in my office, and some days I walk in and I go, yes, look what I've done. And then other days I'm like, oh, look what I've done, I'm really busy. That's why I started working on these comics and animations. So I tried to use that methodology for the first time working with storks. And the first hurdle was you can't interview a stork. They just don't want to talk to you. And so we started working with Martin and the team on how we tell this story, and we use all of your GPS data. And I'm not going to start talking about the science of it, because all I really understand is they put some kind of GPS tracker on the back of a bird. Bird flies, we understand the map. Got it. I'm sure there's a lot more to it, but is that pretty much it? Got it. So these birds fly off here from Germany, and some of them fly out over Europe, over Turkey, down to Africa. And then as far as I can understand, others fly off this way and down through France and Portugal, but they all kind of head south for the winter, thank you. And so we took all of this data from these different GPS settings on these different storks. And then I started working with Carrie, who is probably today the most famous woman in Constance, because I've seen this picture everywhere. I've been WhatsApping her. She's very, very happy. So this is Carrie. Carrie is an awesome artist, and she works with us at Positive Negatives to do these kind of projects with us. And this was a real struggle for her as well, to like, how do you tell this migratory story of these birds in a couple of minutes, because that's the attention span that we have, and I can see I'm losing you, the attention span that we have, and how do we tell these stories through animation? So she works digitally, and she works on this infinite zoom animation, which you will see in a minute in the film. And so what we do is we tell the story, we write the script after we've got all the data from Martin and the team, and we wanted to tell it as almost like a children's poem. The poem 10 Green Bottles, is that, do we know this one? So one by one, the storks start dying from human interaction, whether, like Martin was saying, whether it's pesticides or electricity pylons or being shot or whatever. So we wanted to show how these storks, it's a real struggle for them to get from Germany to South Africa, just like it was for a lot of the people that I interview to get from their country to Europe. So she starts going through all of this and creates these kind of black and white images, and then starts to fill these with her with the color that she works with. And then we start to go through, and this is one of the scenes where the storks are eating the locusts. And these storks actually didn't really die, did they? They just kind of veered off and got distracted by locusts. And so we go through this whole process. And it's a constant, instead of going back to the storks and asking them, are you happy with how this looks and feels and da da da, we go back to Martin and B, and there's the checking, and we're confident that the film that we have made looks like a stork's journey. So this is the world premiere. Thank you.
Once upon a time, in the emerald fields of Germany, two scientists found a little stork with snow-white feathers tipped black as coal. They fitted a small device to her and said, "Go fly, so we may know the journey of your life." And off she flew, joining a flock of 10. Soon, the 10 became hungry and stopped to sniff out food. but some were poisoned with pesticides, and 10 became 8. So on the flock of 8 travelled all across Europe, through gleaming glass cities. But soon the skies darkened, and rain began to pound down on them. 2 came to rest on an electric pylon, and 8 became 6. The 6 flew south across the golden plains of Turkey, Israel, and Egypt, until 2 of the storks stopped to eat in a dump and happily stayed there till spring, while 4 flew on. The 4 storks journeyed on through drought-stricken lands until 2 found their favourite food, a swarm of locusts, leaving 2 to fly further. Now these adventurous 2 storks flew onwards, without knowing they were being watched down the barrel of a gun by 2 hungry huntsmen. And none carried on. Then one little boy found the dead little stork carrying a strange device. He looked up into the heavens and wondered if gods had sent the stork. But far above him floated the International Space Station, which scientists use to communicate with all the creatures that circle the Earth, learning from them how we all can keep our one little planet spinning for centuries to come. Which is why, once upon a time, in the emerald fields of Germany, 2 scientists found a little stork with snow-white feathers tipped black as coal. They fitted a small device to her and said, "Go fly, so we may know the journey of your life." And off she flew, joining a flock of 10. Soon, the 10 became hungry and stopped to sniff out food. But some were poisoned with pesticides, and 10 became 8. So on the flock of 8 travelled all across Europe, through gleaming glass cities. But soon the skies darkened, and rain began to pound down on them. 2 came to rest on an electric pylon, and 8 became 6. The 6 flew south across the golden plains of Turkey, Israel, and Egypt, until 2 of the storks stopped to eat in a dump and happily stayed there till spring, while 4 flew on. The 4 storks journeyed on through drought-stricken lands until 2 found their favourite food, a swarm of locusts, leaving 2 to fly further. Now these adventurous 2 storks flew onwards, without knowing they were being watched down the barrel of a gun by 2 hungry huntsmen. And none carried on. Then one little boy found the dead little stork carrying a strange device. He looked up into the heavens and wondered if gods had sent the stork. But far above him floated the International Space Station, which scientists use to communicate with all the creatures that circle the Earth, learning from them how we all can keep our one little planet spinning for centuries to come.
Thanks so much. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we do, and we did during the creation of that movie. So it's fantastic to also see the background and hear about all that. It's my real pleasure to introduce Wolfgang Fiedler to you guys. Wolfgang is the president of the Ornithological Society of Germany. He's been the head of the bird banding and now bird marking lab for ages, 25 years, 20 years, something like that. And he's taking that into the future to really collect this data to make sure that the technology works. We've seen that not even here it's easy. So this is what's happening every day. And we know that the electronic workshop is also struggling with these issues. We actually now have a big struggle with our satellite thing, that something was blown out that should never be blown out by radiation on the ISS. Just came down again, goes up again in December. So these things happen. And now I think we learn about why storks are so special and what they tell us about migration and why we need to conserve them.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening. Just a few steps back where the whole story starts. So why are we still looking at storks after more than 100 years of science with storks? Shouldn't it be boring at some point? But at the moment, the stork is still the superb species to understand the life of a migrating bird, because it's large and it's really migrating a lot, and everyone knows it and everyone likes it. So the very old pictures already, that's not too old, but the stories are a lot older. People knew that in spring storks are arriving from somewhere. They stay there for summer, bring usually luck to the farmhouse where they breed on, and in autumn they vanish. No one had an idea what they do during winter, but quite early people traveled in Africa and already got the idea, well, there are storks in Africa, couldn't that probably be the same ones? There were expeditions seeing storks in Africa, but it wasn't really something people could believe, that the same stork that sits in northern Germany on the farmhouse is in the wintertime somewhere close to Cape Town, 10,000 kilometers away. And then something very remarkable happened. It was the first marking experiment we had so far in 1822, and further on about 10 or a dozen other occasions, storks brought strange things home to the nests, and of course they were shot because it looked so curious. And people then saw those are arrows, and it was possible to track back where these arrows are used. In that case, it was in southern Sudan. So that was the first proof that this stork must have been in southern Sudan. Someone tried to hunt it. He was not successful, and the stork made it back to Germany. And that was one of the first proofs that they indeed do these migrations. Later on, a lot of scientists discovered the storks as the models for understanding bird migration. The founder of our institute, Johannes Thienemann, started to mark white storks already in 1903 onwards, and he also thought about some experiments. Andrea is doing more or less a sequel of that thing, and she is going to tell us later about that. Then in mid of the 1900s, the social behavior of storks came into interest. This is one of these cases where an infanticide happens. That's something from the dark side of the stork's life. They are not always so nice and neat. So this female is killing one of her chicks, for what reason ever. That is something that has been studied at that time. It's still not understood until today. And also some grouping experiments have been done. Later on, after the Institute came to southern Germany, a lot of population work was done. And at that time, we had to see, or these guys had to see, how the formerly large, big population of storks really crashed. And in the 70s, we had 16 pairs of storks all over Baden-Württemberg. It was almost extinct. In Rheinland-Pfalz, it was completely extinct. Today, we are back at several thousand breeding pairs in the southwest of Germany, and all this has been followed very closely, and we have a lot of data about all these developments. The marking is a very interesting thing. So it was a Danish teacher who invented the bird ringing in Denmark on crows, starlings, and a few storks, and then later on Johannes Thienemann did it on a large scale. And this is one of the first maps we have. That's from 1921. Of storks, that they all have been ringed somewhere here and have been recovered along this route down to South Africa. And stories like that at that time
got, let's say, so they went as viral as it was possible to get viral in that time. So it was really amazing. Millions of people that storks and other birds, we had to think that also little birds like swallows also are doing these things, that these storks are doing these huge migrations. And that was something that was absolutely fascinating for everyone. That also made the stork one of the big models for migration. This is only possible because we have a lot of volunteers everywhere around the world working with white storks, and they are usually our close partners when we do things like attaching loggers or something like that. And then we got this logger technology. In Germany, it was mainly two guys started, or they grabbed this idea from the United States and tried to establish it in Europe. That was Peter Berthold, who is still with us at the Institute today as an emeritus, and Eugenius Novak. And you see one of the problems in the early years, that's not yet a stork, that's a swan. And this huge thing on the back, it looks like a piece of dynamite or something. That is the satellite logger at that time. And it brought, let's say, 15 or 20 coordinates. Everyone was absolutely enthusiastic about that. We still were enthusiastic when we got the first travel routes of white storks. So about 20 coordinates, and then likely not the stork, but the logger broke. But that was the first published map of stork migration, and it was the beginning of that technology. A lot of developments happened since that time. That was 92. And today we have collected a map like that. That's about 400 tracks of white storks between Europe and Africa. And I think that's more or less really showing what white storks are doing. What we see at the first glance is this huge line in the east. That's the eastern migrants. We have heard of that before. Most of them are doing a westward hook towards Lake Chad, and then later probably going further south, even as south as South Africa. And then we have mainly east, mainly west of the River Elbe, we have all the birds flying down on the western route. Most of them now stay in Spain. They benefit from the landfills there, so from the rubbish dumps. Some still go down to Africa, south of the Sahara. Not a single stork ever has been observed crossing the Congo rainforest. That's obviously not possible. They just stay north of it, with a few exceptions of single storks that did not survive it. If you are interested in interesting stories of single storks doing remarkable things a bit off the mainstream, you can see me later on the table over there. I have a few of these stories with me. This is the thing that we are using at the moment. It's one of the GPS logger models that is most reliable and most accurate at the moment, and that's exactly what we use for the storks. If you are, oh, I forgot what? Something? You see, oops. Please come back. Yeah. You see, on the far right, you see this red marks. That's also storks, but they never leave the area. And that was really surprising. This is Uzbekistan, and we expected to find populations of non-migratory storks, for instance, in Tunisia. You see there are lines going down. They migrate. We expected them in southern Spain. You see storks from there also migrate, at least in the first 2 years. Even the storks from Armenia migrated to Mesopotamia, but the ones in Uzbekistan, they don't. That was really surprising, but we know it is possible to survive in Uzbekistan for during the winter. And so at the moment, that's the only really known subpopulation that is not migratory among all storks. The longest migrants are those from Moscow. They have to go a bit southwest first, then cross Turkey, and then go down the main route. And the ones that come from farthest north are usually also the ones that go farthest south. So these migrations are regularly more than 10,000 kilometers per year. If you are interested to follow in, white storks or many other species, you can use our database MoveBank. So the general policy in our institute is that most of the data, as long as it is secure for the animal, is published rather on real time, not exactly on real time, but on the same evening. You can see where your animal was during that day. And most of the stock data is completely open and you can follow it. The problem with MoveBank is this is a huge database created mainly for scientists, and it also needs a huge huge internet connection. So it's sometimes a bit slow to work with it from home. But we have this animal tracker app that is free. You can download it to your mobile phones. And not all, but most of the stocks are on there. And what people do is either looking where they are and check whether there are tagged stocks around, or they have their favorite stocks they follow each day. And I think that's a great way to start thinking how a migrant feels. So it's completely different what we are doing. For us, migration usually is a trip on vacation, except for these tragic cases we have heard of. But most of us are really, really sedentary. Even if we think we are flying around the world all the time, we are typical sedentary animals. And the storks have a completely different life. They are sedentary at longest for a few weeks, and otherwise they are always on the movement around the globe. And this is what applies to many migrating animals. And I think that's something that is really worth trying to understand and following. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Wolfgang. That was really nice to see also the old data, the beginnings of all this migratory science that we're doing. And now the next talk is by Andrea Flack. Her work has been instrumental for the foundation of the new Max Planck Institute, because it was combining the various routes that are followed by the collective behavior group, by our group, and by the social science group or social interaction group. So she has brought that together with her team, with her young team. And it's really exciting to understand more of not just one stork, but really the collective, the swarm of what's happening there. And I think you'll show us that migration is not a single thing. I mean, that's what we've also saw with Ben's data, that, you know, many, many, many are on the move usually, not just one. And that's what we'll hear today.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about my work. And I think Wolfgang gave a really nice overview of what we know about storks and the research that has been done on storks for the last, 200 years now. But what he showed us is that most of what we know of storks comes from observing individual birds. We have observed thousands of individuals throughout their life using bands, using observations, using tracking data in new years. But what we know as well is, and that is an aspect that has hardly been ever studied in the storks, they don't migrate alone. They go in these huge flocks towards the south. They gather together in autumn and build these groups that are hundreds, thousands, ten thousands of birds together. This is a video just before a group is crossing the Strait of Gibraltar, and you can see how they really get together to do this journey as a group. And this is something that hasn't been studied very much in the past, so we don't really know how these birds find each other. We know that they breed kind of territorial in at least most of the times, but when they gather together, when they migrate, they build these huge groups. How do they manage to get together? We don't know how they interact with each other while they're we don't know how they interact with each other while they're in these big flocks. Who is following whom? Who is leading the ray? We don't and this is somehow what I study. I'm trying to understand how these birds move as a collective towards the south. And what we use to find out is these tracking devices. But it isn't enough to just put a GPS tag on a single bird and then learn how they move as a group, because these are wild birds. We can't control them. We can't control who is flying with whom. So what we do is we put a large number of tags in a certain region, tag every bird in a certain area with a GPS tag, 50, 100 birds in the same village, in the same area, and then just look who is flying with whom and just hope that they fly together. And we are also collecting very high resolution data. So That means we get a location of the bird every second to really know how these birds do this as a group. So we can really look inside these flocks to understand who is interacting with whom, who's learning which kind of information from others. And this is an animation of the data we get. So you can really see how these flocks are structured. You can see which bird has which position. And we do not get this only for a single day or a few kilometers, but for the entire migration journey. So, and with this, we can really construct the entire migration, or look at the entire migration. So as Wolfgang said, these storks fly thousands of kilometers. They move from here to Africa. And to do that, they use these thermal updrafts, because they're large, heavy birds that cannot flap their wings. They need to use winds, the environment, to save energy. So they use this these thermal updrafts, these columns of warm air to gain altitude, so that then they can afterwards glide forward in the overall migratory direction. And I'm sorry, I don't know. And to what I would like to find out with my work is, how do they actually use this social information to find these columns of thermals? So who is locating these thermals? How do they navigate towards these thermals? Who is using which kind of social information? And because, and once they're in these thermals, these really dynamic column, I mean, these dynamic atmospheric movements, how do they use the social information to locate the best areas within the thermals? These birds circle in these and try to find the best regions, and then I try to understand how do they determine the path through the thermals, and who is benefiting from whom, and how much energy they save using this social information. And this is an example of the kind of things that we find. So when we look at the movements of the flock, we can find that the individuals within flock have these kind of two distinct behavioral modes. So we have birds that are leading birds, and we have birds that are following birds. The leaders are the ones that are in front of the group, they fly a bit faster, they have frontal positions, they determine the way. And the other birds, the followers, follow these movements. They are usually in the back of the flock, they are kind of observing what the birds in front do, but they have their flight skills are a bit worse. They can't fly as well, so they really need this information coming from the leaders to find the perfect path throughout their migration. And this is also costly for them, because these birds cannot fly as well. They stay a bit behind, and they have to flap more, and it really costs them more energy to stay with the group. But they also benefit from that, because they really see what the others do, what the leaders do, who really track the best path throughout this thermal updraft, and then they can just copy these movements and save, in the end, a bit of energy. And what we observe during these small-scale movements within these thermal updrafts is also reflected in their overall migratory behavior. We see that those birds that are the leading birds are traveling further than those birds that are the following birds. So here you have the migratory path of a group of storks that flew for a bit together, and you can see that each colored line is a path of a bird, and you can see that there are these blue birds that migrate further south, that cross the Sahara and travel all the way to Africa, and these are the birds that were the leaders in the flock. These were the ones that flew better, had more skills in finding the way. And then we have these orange and red birds that were the follower birds. They stay in Europe, they don't fly as far, and so you can really see how this small-scale movements that we observe within these thermaling groups is also somehow reflected in their entire migratory performance, and even in their lifetime performance, because we know that those birds that cross the Sahara have a much lower chance to survive than those that stay in Europe. So this is all somehow connected with each other. What we see on a small scale during flight is connected to what we see on a medium scale during migration, and also on a long-term scale to survive. And this talk so far has been a mixture of animations that we do to somehow convey our message that we find as scientists. But of course, to get to these animations, we really have to sit down and analyze our data using really boring computer programs and Excel sheets and so on. And with the help of computer scientists, we have actually we have now developed a way that we can fly with the storks and get to find out where these storks are and how they interacted with each other using virtual reality. So, and as soon as I stop talking, you can visit me at the one of those little stands over there, where you can really use these virtual reality glasses and fly within a group of the thermaling storks. You can then look around and see who is next to you, and you can really get an impression of how it is like to be flying with a stork. And we as a scientist actually also get quite useful information from us, because we're not just looking at data points in an Excel spreadsheet, but we really can be with the stork out there and really look around who's following whom and how these birds somehow manage to find their path within these circular structures. You can get really dizzy while doing this, and I hope that later on you will visit me there, and I thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Andrea. So you've seen that there's really exciting times ahead of us. What maybe should be added to that is that it now gives us a glimpse into the prediction of a life of an animal. And that's really exciting, because what Andrea didn't mention is that from the first 10 minutes that her entire stork group circled together, first 10 minutes basically gives you the prediction of where they go, how far they go, and how long they survive. And sure, there's some error in there, and there's some room for change. But at least we have a prediction of what an animal is going to do in the wild. And that's really, really exciting. We're getting so precise in these measurements that we can really know what these animals are doing. And for us, that's a major breakthrough. This will, I think, show us the scientific way into the future. Now, we're done with the official talking, and would like to gather back there. There's food and drink, and you're not allowed to bring it out here in the library, but in there, everything's good to have. And there are the stands out here, the information stands, where you can look at the various devices and learn how these animals are being studied and what we find out. And we really like to thank you for coming. We'd like to thank those, I don't know if somebody is here, who is preserving the storks in Böhringen, who's really doing the groundwork. We'd like to thank all the engineers that are building the devices. They're usually in the background. Bruno is there, and engineers from the workshop here. So that's really nice that we have your support, and all the support from the community, from the people that really report these animals. And we're really looking forward to continue that into the future. Thank you very much.